Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, Birmingham Six member Hugh Callaghan on his 16 years in prison and how he's found peace and happiness. Economist Eric Lonergan on his new book, Angrynomics, and how we need to find a new financial global model. Johnny Logan with his new version of True Colours. And singer-producer Gemma Dunleavy on why inner city Dublin is her muse. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Well, first up this morning, some music. Producer, singer and multi-instrumentalist Gemma Dunleavy may have trained at Paul McCartney's Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, but it's where she grew up in Dublin's inner city, which has the most resonance and meaning to her work. Her new single, Up to Flats, is a homage to a world and a community that is changing. I'm delighted to say I'm joined now by Gemma Dunleavy in the line. Morning, Gemma.
Hi, Miriam. Morning. How
Listen, thanks so much for joining us. And we're going to play your song in a moment. I love it. But tell me about it first, your EP. It's a response, really, is it, Gemma, about plans to regenerate the Sheriff Street area in Dublin? I mean, what's going on in the area?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, like, aggressive redevelopment happening. And I was working on a documentary in response to that. I was trying to, like, make a little time capsule, basically, of the area. And kind of at the same time, I was working on music and it kind of just naturally trickled into the music, you know, the team. I was kind of eating, breathing, sleeping, trying to put a stop to the planning permission for this big hotel, 300 million euro hotel and apartment complex development. And at the same time, I was making the record and, yeah, it just naturally kind of fed into what I was writing, you know. So the EP, I was kind of thinking about trying to create a time capsule of, you know, like what I imagine my area to be. And each song is from a different perspective of a stereotype that I grew up around. And Up to Flats is just like a love letter to my community, basically.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful and we will listen to it shortly. Tell me about yourself. You grew up there and do you still live there, Gemma?
Yeah, I still live there. Yeah, I grew up there. I was born in the flats when the Sheriff Street flats were still up. I was born there and then they were knocked down when I was a baby and we moved. We got a house. The houses were built basically on the in the area. And on the site, and we moved into one of the houses there, and I'm still living there now. So kind of the same community, the same people that we lived with in the flats, a lot of them are still around the area, you know. And in the 80s, there was a lot of, like, redevelopment happening, and, you know, like, a certain percentage of them has to go to social housing. And, you know, a lot of the community was promised, you know, oh, we'll do this, we'll give you social housing, we'll provide, like, amenities for the area. And none of it really happened, you know. And now, today, we're having, like, more redevelopment happening. And it's kind of like, you know, years ago when we had nothing, like, we didn't really have any support of the government, of the authorities. We were kind of just out there on our own. All we had was community. And now they're trying to take that away from us when it's all we have, with more aggressive redevelopment. And it's kind of just, you know, like I would just want to stand against that until I'm not here anymore, you know.
Yeah, tell me about the music, where it came from. I think I read you said you owe everything to your parents. They paid for dancing. They encouraged you, didn't they, Gemma?
Yeah. So I danced. I was actually, like, predominantly a dancer when I was a kid, and, like, I was so lucky to be able to go to, like, dance classes, and, you know, like, I did that. I went to dance college as well after school, and like, my parents brought me everywhere, to every dance class, to every competition, and then I got an injury when I was 19 and I ended up going and studying music after that in Liverpool.
You went to the, is it Paul McCartney's college?
Yeah, the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts. So he's the main patron of it. So he would come in and do masterclasses with us and stuff. And that was incredible. That was a great experience. I met so many people there that I still work with today, you know, like really important collaborators. And yeah, that just really changed everything for me.
That it must be what that was an incredible experience. Well, did you actually meet him himself?
Yeah. Because I did a diploma in sound technology first, and then I did a music degree. And you know, like when you're getting your degree, you meet him. He gives you your diploma, and you're like, so yeah. So I met him during those times, but then he would come in and do master classes with us. So we got to meet him during those times.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was great.
Tell me about, because I wasn't that familiar with this, Dr. Martens Presents. It's a great support for artists like you, isn't it? To work on projects and then perform them. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so they reached out to me and they were like, oh, we would love to support you to, you know, you can a project of your choosing, whether it's a video, whether it's a, you know, a live show, whether it's a mixtape. We would love to support you doing that. And so I was at the time working on that documentary, and I was like, I would actually love to make a record. So I pitched the record to them, and they loved it. And it's been really great having the support of them. And you know, like I like from when I was a kid, like I loved Doc Martens. I always wore them. My mum always dressed me in them. So it felt very fitting, you know. And yeah, it was just great having the support of them. They like helped me financially with studio time, and they were producing a full live event. And obviously, then when the lockdown happened, that kind of changed. But now we're doing an online stream, so they've been really helpful with everything from press to, you know, studio time to sorting out the live event. And it was a really, really good pairing. You know, because I've loved Doc Martin since I was a little kid, you know.
Tell me about the live stream before we listen to your song. It's on the 16th of July. If people want to listen to it, what is it and how can they listen?
Yeah, so it's going to be on the 16th of July, and it's basically going to be like a live show, but you'll be watching it instead of being there, you know. I'm going to have me and my collaborators will be playing the songs, the full EP. I'll be giving a little bit of background on the concept and you know how the songs are made and kind of where they came from, and it'll be on the Dr. Martens website. It's going to be live streamed on their website, on their YouTube, on their Instagram, and if I'll also share on my Instagram and social media platforms through Gemma Dunleavy.
Well, look, we're going to listen to it now. Your new single, Up to Flats, by you, Gemma Dunleavy. It's available now. The full EP, I think, is being released on the 10th of this month.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
Gemma, thanks for chatting to me, and we're going to listen now.
Thanks, Miriam.
Yeah, best of luck in the future now. And we listen now to your song, Up to Flats. Great new single, Up to Flats, by Gemma Dunleavy, is available now, and the full EP of Gemma's is going to be released on the 10th of July. Well, look, we move on to economics. Beautifully simple, logical and absolutely doable ideas zip off the pages. So says economist David McWilliams about a new book by two economists called Angrynomics. In the book, Eric Lonergan and Mark Blythe suggest that our current economic model is all wrong. It's created too much inequality, which may explain the rise of anger and populism, and could be said to even explain Trump, Bolsonaro and even Brexit. Well, joining me now on the line is one of the authors of the book, Eric Lonergan. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks
Very
so
nice
much
to be here with you this morning.
Great book. For my listeners, it's a Sunday morning. Tell them what your central thesis is in this great book.
Okay. Well, I think probably the most accessible and in many ways the most important aspect of the book is that anger is a very misunderstood emotion. So everybody knows what anger is. But if you're anything like me before I wrote this book, I'd no idea whether anger was a good or a bad thing, why people were getting angry, what does it tell us about a human being that they get anger, and all of these different dimensions. And that's ultimately what the book is about. And then we try, once we try to get our head around the emotion, which is misunderstood, we try to come up with some ideas that may explain why we're witnessing this sudden outpouring.
And what are the reasons? I mean, you speak a lot about three versions of capitalism, don't you? Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, maybe if I could, Miriam, just backtrack a little bit. The interesting thing with anger. So if I said to you, what are the different types of anger? Again, most people, I'd never really thought about this. And in the book, we make really four distinctions. So the first one is between public anger and private anger. So the anger that people feel in their everyday lives is typically a signal of distress. Often it's associated with shame. So if you think of like anger management or self-help, if you had a colleague who suddenly started getting angry, you'd probably take them to one side and say, listen, is everything okay?
Yeah.
So it's indicative that something's going wrong. Now in the public sphere, it's very, very different. So if you stopped an Extinction Rebellion protester and said, why are you getting angry? They've probably got righteousness. They'd almost say you should be angry too, because look at the damage we're doing to our environment. We're not thinking about future generations. You know, we're destroying our air, we're destroying our land. So public and private anger are two very, very different things. And then within public anger, there's these two very different sides. There's moral outrage and there's what we describe as a kind of tribal energy. And one is the anger of angels and the other is the anger of devils. Now, once you have this lens, you can make an awful lot of sense of politics.
Are you sure?
I think so. We can certainly have a go. Well, let me give you some examples, right? So if you think like to make it absolutely real today, if you look at Black Lives Matter, and that is a very good example of moral outrage. And even, you know, if you go back into the philosophy of it, that dates back to the Greek philosophers talked about moral outrage and anger as a kind of appropriate response. It's almost a measure of your character. And I don't know if you saw, there was a great interview on CNN with Cornel West, who's the sort of one of the intellectual forefathers, kind of the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And he said, what would it say about our society if people weren't protesting? Yeah, you know, if you could see that level of police brutality on your screen and you did nothing about it. So in a sense, it's a measure of your moral compass. So that's one side, which in a sense tells us that there people observe wrongdoing, can witness injustice, and we need to listen to that. And I think that's the sort of positive anger that needs to be addressed. There's another side to it, though, that's much more pernicious. And this is what we call like the angry fan. And this was a turning point for me. This was a real light bulb moment. It was going to football matches and suddenly thinking, why is there a small group typically of men who are getting really, really angry? And they don't just get angry at the opposition. They also get angry at their own team. And suddenly we realize that these are little tribal regulators, that there's a small minority of people who can be very easily triggered and they want everybody to be tribal. And now to relate this to politics, you will see Trump and a lot of the populace exploiting these two different faces of anger when it suits them. And angry people are more likely to vote. So suddenly you have a kind of story about how this might affect politics.
And put simply, though, as well, Eric, I assume a lot of people, even people who voted for Trump, they feel the way our economies are largely run at the moment are not for their benefit. In other words, they feel it is an unequal world, which is becoming even more unequal.
Absolutely. And I think the evidence on that is overwhelmingly the case. You know, we have documented data now that most of the economic gains over the last 20 years a large majority of them have gone to a very tiny segment of the population. It can't be. Surely we can do better than have a society where 90% of the assets are held by the top 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. I think that's almost a self-evident truth. And that's, we try, and similarly, I think it's a self-evident truth that we need to do something about the environment. But we don't need to present it as this incredibly difficult task that requires everybody to completely change their lives and we don't stand a chance. We need to have real practical solutions that we can do that will improve people's lives relatively simply and relatively quickly. And that's where we try. That's ultimately at the end of the book, we come up with three or four proposals because we think there is a huge economic opportunity at the moment.
Yeah. And one of your big ideas, which is really interesting, is, you know, to create a national wealth fund, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
What is that and how would that work?
Okay, well, that is really, really simple. So if you take the Irish government as an example, but this is true across the developed world, the Irish government can issue 20-year bonds. That means it can borrow for 20 years and pay zero interest rate. Mm. Now, my day job, I'm an investor. One thing we know in investing is if you can make a rate of return on your investment above your cost of capital, right? So in other words, if the Irish government can make an investment with a return that's higher than zero, it will create value just by compound interest, right? That's just a law of mathematics. Now, our example is if you look at Norway, Norway has a sovereign wealth fund, which they initially funded with oil revenues. That fund over 20 years has generated a 6% return. Now, if Ireland borrowed for 20 years and said to the private sector, we're going to set up a proper independent authority with proper governance. We're going to issue the debt. We're going to hand you the funds and you're to generate us a 6% return on average, 4 to 6% over the next 20 years. Within 15 years, you can repay the debt and you still have the assets, right? We have an incredible gift at the moment, which is that our interest rates are so low and we could use that to our advantage. So that would be, Ireland could set up a sovereign wealth fund on exactly that basis. It does nothing to your balance sheet. On day one, your balance sheet is unchanged. You have an increase in debt and an increase in assets. Over time, though, your assets should be able to grow by more than zero over 15 or 20 years. You genuinely need an apocalypse, right? Unless a meteor hits the world, in which case we've got bigger problems. But absent that, in 15 or 20 years' time, you can repay the debt. So my suggestion is we should set up national wealth funds and distribute ownership to the people in society who don't have a share, who don't have a stake in the system. And that way, they have an inheritance, a national inheritance that says, in 15 years' time, you may have a sum of money that you'll be able to use for housing, for education, for health, but you have a stake. And that's something we could do within 6 months, and you could tackle inequality in quite a big way.
Mm-hmm. One of your other solutions as well, Eric, is a data dividend, and, you know, in the big tech companies. Is that the idea that they'd be required to pay us for the use of our private data, basically?
Well, here's the thing that's really interesting is you have these extraordinarily profitable global businesses, and most of their value now, or a lot of their value, resides in the data, and the data is in effect ours. Mm-hmm. So our idea there is, well, let's just enforce our property rights and say, if you want to have our data, you should pay for it like anything else. And they're monopolies. In many cases, they're close to monopolies. They're dominant. If you look at Facebook, which owns Instagram and Facebook, it's pretty much dominant within that area. So what we could do is auction our data as a nation, just like we auction to the mobile companies to have spectrum and to transmit mobile functions. So we could do the same with the technology companies. And again, that would give people a very, very small, but it would give people an income stream. Because there's an idea of basic income, which you're probably familiar with, universal basic income, mm-hmm. is the idea to try and give everybody in society a minimal level of income, which I think in principle people can appeal to. The problem with that, I think, is there's a sense that you shouldn't get something for nothing. This wouldn't be something for nothing. This is, after all, our data. And as a society, we have a right to auction it.
Really interesting. And also, you talk about borrowing money, Eric, to invest in green projects such as wind power. Again, tell me about that. And also, finally, how will that trickle down, though, I suppose, to make sure our world is increasingly less unequal? Because that's key, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, I think that the real way to tackle inequality, as I see it, there are sort of three major ills. And in a sense, this is the moral outrage that we could harness in a productive way, which is to do with the environment, which is to do with wealth inequality, and which is to do with the costs of recession. And we're witnessing that again now where recessions cause huge economic suffering, huge concern about the future and worry, and also just huge economic harm and harm to people's incomes. And so we need to have clever solutions to those three. Now, and on the environment, a lot of this can be done with the state. And again, it goes back to the point, if you can borrow at zero interest rates, you can fund capital investment. So if you think of the energy sector, in most countries, the price of energy is regulated by the government, which means the government can effectively determine the return that the energy sector makes. Well, if the Irish government can fund itself at zero and can determine the return that it makes within the energy sector, it's guaranteed, in a sense, to make a profit. Right. So what it should absolutely do is accelerate investment. If you look at wind, you know, wind generation can be built. It's one of the great advantages of wind is it can be built very, very quickly. You can build wind turbines can be up and running within 2 years. So there's absolutely, we need to be way more ambitious. Where I would fault the political class is a lack of ambition. And the challenge now is, in a sense, the populations are more ambitious than their politicians. And we need to say we have a solution to this problem because we genuinely do. We have the technology and we have the financial resources. We're going to be way more ambitious. You know, let's have 90% electric vehicles in Ireland within 5 years. Let's have 75% renewable energies. That's doable, right? But there needs to be the will.
Absolutely. Well, look, it's a really interesting read. Angrynomics, your book. Eric Lonergan wrote it, and Mark Bly. Thanks so much, Eric, for chatting to us this morning. Lots of food for thought.
It's a pleasure, Miriam. Take care now.
Take care. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, last week I heard a report in Morning Ireland about the Irish Elderly Advice Network in Camden and how it was looking after our older emigrants. One person in the report which caught my ear was the wonderful Hugh Callaghan, one of the Birmingham Six, who, as we all know, spent 16 long and terrible years in a British prison for those horrific murders in 1974, a heinous crime that he, of course, had absolutely nothing to do with. It remains one of the greatest miscarriages of justice of all time. Well, now nearly 90, Hugh loves singing and sounds very happy in his life. And I'm delighted to say I'm now joined on the line by Hugh Callaghan. Hugh, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Listen, how has the lockdown been for you? How have you found it?
That's okay. I'm just getting on with life, not just carrying on. That's it, like, you know. Yeah.
And I heard you during the week on Morning Ireland, and I know you were there with Sally Mulready.
Yes.
And how important is that Irish Elderly Advice Network to people living in London like you, Hugh?
It's fine because it takes you amongst your own type of people, especially Irish people, elderly people, you know what I mean? But since I've lived in London, I've always been amongst the Irish people, like, and I've always felt the Irish people, I've always done a bit of singing with them all, like, you know, so I like to be amongst them all, you know what I mean? Yeah.
And I know your partner, Adeline, is a very important part of your life.
She is very good. She's very good to me, yes, she is indeed. And she's a good woman. Adeline is, yes.
Which is great to have.
Yeah, she is.
Listen, Hugh, can you go back? Where did you grow up?
Me grew up? I grew up in Belfast, okay. And I came to Birmingham first in 1947. I was only 17 years of age, so I'd been away a long, long time from Belfast.
Tell me about your childhood and your parents, Hugh. Remind me.
My mother wasn't actually from Belfast. She was from outside Belfast, but my father was from the shipyard side. But my father went away a long, long time ago, and my mother was she was from just in the outskirts of Belfast, and she had a big family, like her family was sisters and so forth, you know.
And were there many in your own family, Hugh? Many children?
My own family. Yeah. Oh yes, there was. She has quite a few. Yes, there was about seven of us in our family. Yes. Yeah, and all my brothers are all now dead. Yeah.
Oh. Are you the only one of your siblings alive?
I only got one. That's my sister, Patsy. And she lived in Belfast. Yeah.
And why did you go to Birmingham so young? Like 17 these days. It's so young, Hugh.
Well, the thing was, the reason why I went away because I couldn't get any work in Belfast at particular times. So I had got to go in and get a job. It was important for me to get some work and to get some money. Mm. And that's the reason why I went away. Because in those days, there wasn't much work in Belfast.
No.
You know? So I had to get away and get jobs. And I got jobs in London and especially in Birmingham, you know. So that was the main reason. The main reason was I went away to get work. Yes.
Yeah. And for many people listening now, Hugh, they'll know a little bit about the Birmingham Six, but they won't remember all the detail.
Yes.
Can you remember, Hugh, if you don't mind me asking you, when was the first moment you got arrested? Can you remember that? And could you even remember what was going on?
Well, it was a shock to me when they came and arrested me up for not me.
Mm.
And I was in the next day, like, you know what I mean? And I couldn't believe it, like, you know? And it's unbelievable, like, you know? Because I probably was standing around near the pubs or something like that, and it's probably, or they probably suspected me, like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What stage did you realise that you were actually going to end up going to prison for this, for something you never did? When did it dawn on you that this wasn't a nightmare, that this was actually happening to you?
I had a terrible time with the police. And the thing was, and they threatened me, and dogs and everything with me, and they put dogs in the cell with me, and they frightened the light out of me. And they were getting statements out of me, frightened the light out of me to say things that I didn't do.
Mm.
And it was just terrible. It was a terrible ordeal, you know.
Mm.
And as I was a very, very, very nervous person, it was so easy for them. And they knew it, of course. And it was so easy for them to get a statement out of me, you know what I mean? And so it was terrible. And I never, even to the present day, I get still nightmares about those statements and the way they treated me. Yeah. And they beat me about the place, and kicked me and everything, you know. It was terrible, yeah.
And you still get nightmares about that, Hugh?
I still get nightmares, oh yes, I do indeed. And I fell out of bed at night, thinking they were still kicking me. And I fell out of bed twice, and my party a few times had picked me up from the floor in the middle of the night. Yeah, yeah.
When you think back on those officers now...
Yes.
Do you hate them or do you forgive them? What's your feeling towards those people?
Well, the thing is, you can't afford to think about it much. You try as much as just possible to forget about it.
Mm.
And they also, as regards hating is concerned, you can't go around hating them. Because the thing is, that would only make you worse. You know what I mean? If you go around saying yourself, you hate, thinking about what happened to you. I mean, they honestly be quite truthful. I have nightmares about it at particular times, but I don't go around every day just about thinking about it, which you can't do because it just makes you a bit ill. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were the court cases surreal when you look back on them? I mean, the original. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, they were. They were. They were. It was bad in the court, you know what I mean? It was bad, like, you know, getting things that were saying about you and you hadn't got a clue, spicy, you know, everybody was against you, you know what I mean? And then, of course, like, the things you had to put up with, like, you know, and people would suspect me of this, calling this and calling that, and it was just horrible.
How did you keep going at that stage, even before the 16 years you spent in prison, Hugh, when you were in the court and people were saying things that you knew were lies?
Yeah.
How did you survive that? You know, did you not want to scream out?
Well, the thing is, I did have a terrible nervous breakdown over it all because it was getting to me. Because people were saying things to me, calling me this, calling me that, and the whole thing. And it was just terrible. And I did Even to the present day, I still have some terrible dreams about it, to what happened to me, and that was a long time ago. But I still have memories of it to the present day. It's a thing that I will never forget, especially the way I was treated and the way I was kicked the bird and so forth and so forth. Especially when you were getting this done to you, when you had done nothing.
And like, even hearing your voice, you're so patiently such a gentle person.
Well, people say that. Mm. Yeah, well, that's probably fair. See, people say I'm pretty laid back, you know what I mean? So that's it. But that's just my, probably it's just my nature, like, you know.
Mm.
You know. Yeah.
Lovely nature. What was prison like? Was it horrific at the beginning? Did it get better? What was prison like?
Well, I'll tell you this. Prison, especially when you're in for something like that, you'd be the most hated person under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You were, nobody looked at you and they called you this and called you that and called you the other. And it was a terrible experience to be in there. And especially when you were walking around, especially when you had to go amongst them, walking around the exercise yard, and we're calling you this and calling you that, and it was a terrible ordeal. And sometimes I wouldn't go out because it was getting to me. Yeah, and then I started walking, like, you know what I mean, up there, you know what I mean. But it was an ordeal because when your friends had sort of thing, if the other place didn't like you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like, and it didn't like people that was in for other things, like, no, bad things, like, no. Yeah. And that was terrible, like, you know?
Did it get easier over the years, Hugh, or did it get harder? I mean, was it 16 years you spent in prison?
Yeah. Very hard. Very, very hard. I've dead that straight and plain. It was very, very hard. Especially harder stuff, because as one, I can remember this clearly in my this prisoner coming over to me on the outside, and he come over to me and he said to me, "I don't know how you stuck it in there." He says, "You were in there." He says, "For something you didn't do," but he says it was terrible. He said, "We done something." This is a guy,
mm-hmm.
And he said, "We done something, but you done nothing." And he said, "I don't know how you stuck it." He says, and that was the word he said to me. And this fella, yeah, and my friend was with me at that particular time,
mm-hmm.
And she admired the man saying that to me, yeah.
Were any of the prison guards or wardens kind at all? Towards the end, did any of them start to believe you, Hugh, when you said you didn't do it? No,
not really, They don't bother. They don't bother you. But especially it's all according to what prison you were in. You know what I mean?
Mm.
There's hard prisons that you're treated. All prisons are treated very bad, and same some prisons, which I won't mention. But there's other prisons that were very like easygoing sorts of prisons, and it was all right. But then that type of prisons, you know what I mean?
Mm.
But even that, but one way or another, they even. Even if you were an innocent person, they wouldn't believe you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They were there to do one thing, was just to stop, keep you in there, and that's it. And me, and that's it, like, you know. Yeah.
Did you sing some of the time? That's what I heard the other morning on Morning Ireland, which I thought was so touching, that at one stage, some of the prisoners were nice to you because they discovered you could sing.
Yeah. That was it. But even one of the prison officers said, because I used to go in and a lot was hard in there, but sometimes it sort of me, like, I didn't care sometimes where I was. If I felt like singing a song, I'd sing a song.
Yeah.
So I was in the shower this particular day, and this prison officer, like, you know, he was a good bloke, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he heard me singing. And he held himself and he started singing along with me.
Oh.
And he said to me, he said, "You can sing." He said, I said, "Yeah, I can," like, you know. So what was that, like, you know? Yeah.
Can you remember what you were singing that day?
Oh, Sweet 16.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Sweet 16. Oh, yeah. And then I sang it. And then, of course, like, when we were all at the congregation, all sitting together, like, out there, and then one of them came out and said that I could sing a song. And then I sang the song in front of all the prisoners. And then, you know, in the prison, sometimes, like, you never spoke to one, or we didn't know. But when I was just singing the song, like, so, And the next couple of days, people have just said hello to me because I sing the song. Yeah.
So I'm going to keep talking, but you might sing, you said, something now if you felt up to it, Hugh. Anything you like, whatever you like. We might take two songs, so...
Do you want me to sing a song now?
Yeah. Okay, then. In your own time, Hugh.
Okay, then. We all have a song in our hearts, a song that reminds us of someone. It may be the strain of a that calls back to memories of walks down the lane. It may be an old lullaby for songs bluebirds sing as they fly. And in all the long years, with our laughter and tears, we all have a song in our
Okay. That's beautiful, Hugh. Beautiful at any age, but the fact that you're just about to hit 90. So I was just going to ask you, was it tough, Hugh? You know, in 1980, I think, it was the second appeal when Lord Denning made that infamous statement about the appalling vista.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that a really tough moment?
It was. It was a very tough moment indeed. It was hard, it was. When they turned around and said those things,
But you never gave up hope.
I never gave up hope. Oh no. We just had to. I mean, the thing was, you just had to keep going, like, you know, and get on with things, like. Yeah, and I got thousands and thousands of cards from people all over the world. Yeah, it was great, and that was great encouragement, and that brought me up because I knew a lot of people was for us. Yeah, and the Kennedy family, they all wrote to me. Yeah, they did, and it was great. And having all them things happen to you and people, and I know, and the Kennedys come to see us, one of the Kennedys. Yeah, it was great.
It was great.
Yeah.
Were you religious when you were in prison? I mean, did that help you at all? Do you have faith? Did that keep you going or not?
I went to Mass in the prison. I never miss Mass. I went to priest. They call him. And I can roll this and the Roman Catholic priest. I said to him, I said it was innocent. You know what he said to me? He said, "Oh, come on," he says. He didn't. The priest didn't believe me.
Oh.
The RC priest didn't believe me. And then I had another priest, which was very, very good to me. So it was quite different, like, you know.
When you got out eventually, I think March the 14th, 1991.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was great. I was very nervous, mind you. I tell you, I was very nervous amongst all those people. But it was great to get out there, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because with all them people outside, I knew like all them people believed them, you know, and it was great, like, you know. So, and it was great, and the Mulready family was very good to us, like, you know.
And I think, like, all of you I've spoken to before, Hugh, it's very difficult to go back to normal life after spending that long in prison, isn't
very
it?
Very hard, very difficult.
Mm.
Right, because you don't know what's happening. Because so many things change, and it's hard to adjust. know what I mean?
Mm.
It took me a long time to adjust. Yeah.
And you seem happy in yourself today, are you, Hugh?
I'm coming used to me. You know, I'm easily laid back person, know what I mean, and things like that. That's it, yeah. The thing is, I get along, I'm happy with myself, that's the way I could say that, I suppose we, Well, I have a friend, you know what I mean, I have a good friend on that, and she looks after me, and you know, a nice little home, and she's very, very kind to me, and that's it, she's very kind to me, and it was a great thing to meet her, and she looked at me, and this is good,
I read somewhere that you said Adeline saved you in a way, Hugh.
Adeline did save me. She did save me. She definitely did. I'll tell you, absolutely plain. She did. I'll tell you one thing. I'll have been lost without her. Even today and in years ago. Mm. Oh, yes. Definitely. Yeah. She understood the whole situation, you see.
Mm.
She understood. Because it was very difficult for people to understand the situation and they wouldn't bother with you. Know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But there was some people that did understand the situation, and Sally was one of them. No, she knew the whole situation, as regards what they could do to you, know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's lovely you met her. Where did you meet her?
I'll ask her out. Where did I meet you? I met her at the church social, as I can remember it now.
As I say, such a gentle person you seem, and thank you so much, and love to your Adeline as well.
I will do, yes, thank you.
Mind yourself, take care, Hugh.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Lots of lovely reaction to Hugh Callaghan there, the Birmingham Six. No time to read it, though. The Vintage Boombox, well, they're a band which rework well-known pop songs in a Latin and jazz style. And during the lockdown, they've made their own versions of Spandau Ballet's Gold, Police's Roxanne and Diamonds Are Forever. But for their latest project, a new video of the wonderful song True Colours, they brought in no other than the great talent that is Johnny Logan. And Johnny joins me now. Morning, Johnny.
Good morning, Miriam.
Hi, how are you? Listen, tell me about this song. And it's dedicated, isn't it, Johnny, to all the frontline workers?
Well, that was, absolutely. That was something that Ray and Cormac from the band asked me when we agreed to do it. They said, should we do this? And I said, absolutely. You know, anything we can, in this particular time of our lives, like I said, anything that I can do that'll just lift people's spirits, you know. The two guys playing the Late Late Band, Ray and Cormac, they've always been so kind to me, Ryan and all the people there. So, the opportunity to pay them back a little bit, pay the boys back as well, was something that I couldn't miss that opportunity.
And it's a beautiful version. When you take on a song, Johnny, that everyone knows so well, like True Colours, how do you make it your own? I mean, you did, but how do you do that?
I'm just thinking about how I made it my own. The only way that I could record it, because the lads wanted a video of it as well, was I called a friend of mine, Paul Daly, who owns the pubs in the centre of Munich. And I went in, and his mandolin player, Paul Zelensky, has a sound system. So he recorded my voice while I sang to the backing track, and Paul videoed me singing it at the time, and it was done in two takes. So I was more concerned with trying to get it the melody right, and trying to and get the timing right with the rhythm of the bossa nova thing, then focused on normally you'd have a couple of hours in a studio or an hour to play around with things. So you just had to get it right immediately, and it was, I think, the song itself, though, the groove kind of dictated very much, how you should sing it.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose everything during lockdown, people just do things differently. And in a way, it sounds perfect. We're going to listen to it in a while. It sounds beautiful. But have you found lockdown is you're ending up doing things in very different ways?
I'm kind of lucky at this stage because, my career was, I managed to, make myself well known all over Europe. And at the moment, I'm in Munich. And I was in Austria, in a place called Wachau. Mm. Up the mountains near Krems, and doing a TV show about 4 days ago on a ledge about 500 or 600 feet up off the ground, for 3 hours while a drone was going around me, miming to What's Another Year. But I think that kind of sums it up, because there's nothing I wouldn't do to be involved in the music business at the moment, to just keep working. It's like my world stopped. I thought, This is the 1980, 40 years since Watson of the Year. My diary was full of TV shows, great gigs and stuff like this. And suddenly it stopped. And your first concern, obviously, is about your family and friends and all the fans that I had, about their health and everything else. And then as it's gone on and on and on, you start to wonder, will the business ever come back? Will it ever be the same? If it does come back, you know, you worry about your musicians, you worry about... So you live with that constant insecurity on top of the normal insecurity of being part of the music industry. I think I am lucky in so much as that, I've got loads of different projects that have come in. I've just been involved with, I've written a song for a charity organization here in Germany. And I actually wrote it for a group of other singers. And now they want me to sing it. So I'll be recording that in Denmark, I hope, before the end of the month. And, I'm involved with this project with Vintage Boombox. And I do a lot of stuff online, you know, for people who are just, you know, they send in a mail to me or whatever. And, you know, I'm sort of just to cheer them up. I try to do as many things as I can online. But to be honest, a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing online, people are doing all these concerts and stuff like this. And part of me is afraid that, like, sort of people will think that's the normal, that that is the way, you know, like that is going to be the future, and forget about live gigs. And that worries me, because my mainstay in my life has always been my live work. And I can't wait to get back on a stage. You know, the reality of it is that I don't tend to do too many things, online. Because, like I said, I'd like to make the stuff as high quality as I possibly could that I'm involved with.
Of course. Well, hopefully things will get back at some stage to some kind of normality, Johnny.
Yeah.
But listen, thank you so much. I know you're in Munich. Miriam, for chatting to me this morning. We're going to listen now to,
thank
with
you,
the Vintage Boombox, your wonderful version
I know my cousin Miggy and my family are listening back home, that I miss them all terribly. And and I know there's a lot of people tuning in from all over Europe, because we put it online that I was going to be doing the show today. So just all my love, stay healthy, and I'm looking forward to getting home, and also looking forward to being back on the road again with my musicians. And please, Miriam, you, Sian, and everybody else that's working on the Miriam at One, look after yourselves.
Thanks so much for that, Johnny. So we're going to go out listening. First of all, thanks to my producer, Sian O'Gorman, on the sound, Mark McGrath. And we go out listening to Johnny Logan with the Vintage Boombox, True Colours.
You with the sad eyes, and don't be discouraged. Oh, I realise it's hard to take courage in a world full of people. You can lose sight of it all. The darkness inside you can make you feel so small. Yeah. Can't remember.